SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Monday. Race fans, for the first time in over 3 weeks, I can say, from my desk, from the home studio here in Greenwich. Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website too, stevepick.com. And the prep season is behind us. It is over. Now there's just the fine-tuning and the waiting and watching for those that might be sitting on the outside looking in. And that situation arose for a few horses, the way things shook out on Saturday, particularly in the Arkansas Derby. So much to digest from the weekend that really started on Friday, particularly at Keeneland and Oaklawn. The Grade 1, Makers 46, and Jimmy Jerkins, and Delta Prince. We'll talk to Jimmy later, hour 3. And at Oaklawn, the start of an enormous weekend, a daily trek to Winner's Circle and to the Winner's Circle inside the Winner's Circle, outside the Winner's Circle, on the other side, on the lawn, for Steve Asmussen and his clients, Mitoli and Lady Apple, and then yesterday in a thrilling stretch duel that involved Midnight Bisou, did not involve the obvious other player going into the race. In fact, it was Escape Clause, Don Chanel's the Manitoba bred, and a terrific conclusion to the Racing Festival of the South, although the racing, which is awfully festive at Oaklawn, did not conclude. It continues on, where they're inviting you to stay until May and play until May. They will go another 3 weeks, and the new territory, really new territory, for the racing at Oaklawn and for the Hot Springs faithful. And boy, you want to see how people respond under difficult circumstances. The weather that rolled in on Friday night and into Saturday morning and through Saturday afternoon and Saturday night. And when I left Oaklawn on Saturday, the crowd, you know, was still coming. I tried to get to Memphis for a flight home and missed the later portion of the day, but people didn't care. They didn't care how much rain was coming and what they were going to deal with. It's such a unique place. You come once and you can't help but want to come every year, and met, again, more people this year and in these few days, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Just, you meet people at night, you know, very similar to Saratoga, where there's people, you know, that have come and come every year, and you know, they just live and breathe the game at Hot Springs, and it's such fun to be there, even under, you know, the difficult ambient conditions Saturday. To go through and touch on, you know, the big moment and the biggest portion of Saturday and Friday and the whole thing, and you talk about Omaha Beach and, you know, coming back after the Rebel, and Omaha Beach is going to propel himself and Richard Mandela maybe to Derby favoritism he's going to head to the Downs immediately, and will train 3 weeks almost at Churchill. This is a big win and an exciting proposition, I think, for everything that will happen, you know, the next 3 weeks. You know, given the storylines of Bill Mott and Richard Mandela, and their potential, either one, to win a Derby. And meanwhile, Improbable, who worked out a trip, I mean, as best he could. I thought Smith was brilliant on Omaha Beach. Jose Ortiz deserves a lot of credit because Improbable was, you know, in a difficult spot. You don't ever want to be down inside on a wet day like that at Oaklawn. And didn't take Ortiz long to get Improbable off the inside and then out into the clear, then challenging, turned away, and kept at bay the rest of the stretch. But not a bad performance by Improbable at all. And it's funny that, you know, Baffert's gonna head to Churchill with three players, Improbable and Roadster and Game Winner, and isn't necessarily the headline, I don't think. I think once we get there, we've all heard as much as you'd want to hear over the years, I think Baffert will relish being a little bit in the background. Not that he didn't send out a 9-furlong prep winner in Roadster, but it's a pretty interesting situation that he comes in with Game Winner and Improbable, and they're going to be, you know, shuffled down a little bit, maybe, in the pecking order in people's minds, with Tacitus and Roadster and Omaha Beach and Maximum Security, you know, being the most recent 9-furlong winners. So the stories taking shape. We'll have to go through the, you know, the list and see what happened potentially to some of the horses that you were trailing and looking at and seeing if they were going to get in. The ones that got pushed aside based on the points for now. Bodie Express, the maiden, sitting at 21. Signalman, 22. They've got 40 and 38 points, respectively. Another Twist of Fate, who ran okay, but was not good enough under the circumstance in the Lexington. He's got 38, but he's got less money than Signalman. So sitting 23rd is another Twist of Fate with 38 points. Sueno, 32. Bourbon War, 31. And Instagram, 30, etc. So 40 points ended up being the cutoff, spinoff down there with 40. Gray Magician, 41. Country House gets in with that. They kind of chug along third in the Derby on Saturday. He gets in, and so forth. The rest of it, everybody that you knew and everybody you expected, but it was Omaha Beach and Improbable, most notably, you know, having to secure their spots, and they did more than what they had to do, really. It was pretty satisfying on that front in terms of getting the right, you know, the horses that have been best and most anticipated getting in. Long Range Toddy, he didn't have to really do anything. He was in. He ran okay. We'll talk to Steve Asmussen. We'll get Steve's thoughts. We'll talk to Steve in the second half of this hour. Just a tremendous 3 days. Lady Apple with the upset in the Fantasy on Friday. A terrific ride by Santana. getting down inside. But you know what? Motion to Motion ran fine. Jack Van Berg's pace setter ran very well. It was a good second, and Santana with the daring maneuver scoots up the rail with the daughter of Curlin. And then Mattoli, as we mentioned, and Mattoli, you knew, was gonna be hard for Whitmore to corral Mattoli under those circumstances, and that's the way it played out. 107 Beyer, if you hadn't seen the figure. And then Asmussen capped it off yesterday with Midnight Bisou, Bloom Racing, Jeff Bloom, and that was really, what a great conclusion of the weekend. An absolute thriller. So, as always, the Racing Festival of the South delivers. It was a little different. It was just the way they broke it up from the Friday, Saturday into the Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It had a little bit of a different flow, and there were lots of good races in between. Should mention, of course, Quip and Lone Sailor. 1-2 in the Oaklawn Handicap. That was exciting. Everybody dealt with the wet track, and nobody really, I don't think, it didn't feel like, at least I haven't seen any stories or any aftermath that anybody was completely compromised by the wet track. Also, yesterday in that fifth season, Doug O'Neill, another one of the California expat horses, Fight On, won the fifth season. And there were some notable performances under the radar away from the glare of the stakes at Oaklawn over the weekend, including, how about Brad Cox sending out on Friday Warrior's Charge, the Munning Son, and Marshall Graham and his fun group that made the most of the weekend. They were unperturbed, the 10 Strike Racing team. They didn't mind the inclement weather. Still a little bit in the afterglow of that Friday performance by Warrior's Charge, that heady allowance that had Soldado and many more, the race we had talked about with Ron Moquette. But Warrior's Charge was spectacular in that allowance. You would have thought immediately, well, this could be a Preakness horse, except not nominated. Not Triple Crown nominated. So they'll look elsewhere with Warrior's Charge. It only took 24 hours, though, for Brad Cox to get a Preakness starter because, of course, Owendale won the Lexington. And Owendale, a horse we talked about, you know, earlier in the winter, looked like he was knocking on the door in this arena. And he clearly, with that effort, 98 Beyer in there. So Brad Cox with two terrific three-year-old performances Friday and Saturday. We'll might not talk to Brad today, but certainly by tomorrow. There's a ton to wade through, and that included the turf sprint action, including Rusty Arnold, Morticia in that Giant's Causeway. How about Ian Wilkes sending out Bourbon Resolution? And even though Scully's Friday push ran okay, but it was Bourbon Resolution who he liked in the Ben Alley that made your weekend if you went in that direction with James. So good job there. Rushing Fall with her return in the Wiley. Chad Brown and Bob Edwards, Javier Castellano aboard. Castellano sweeping the grade ones Friday, Saturday. He was on Delta Prince for Jimmy Jerkins and the whole Stronach family involved in Delta Prince. Well, mother, father, son, anyway. And there was one more somewhere in there. There were a couple of allowances, too. I've got all the – I was waiting for the figs yesterday, and so I poked around and gathered the results for – the non-stake races as well. And there were some interesting names, some interesting horses too that that we had talked about a little bit, including how about with Asmussen, the Lady Tack. There was that Lady Tack that came up, the McLean's Music, the Hill and Dale. Poet streamed, and she was a winner at First Asking. And how about Moquette, speaking of the maidens, how about getting a win for the Sellers? That was great. Breaking news breaks the maiden on Saturday. Awfully nice for Louis and John Sella. That was nicely done. The coach got a win too. Gray Sky, that nice Gray Sky who's kept his form for a while. How old is he now? He's got to be at least five, right? He's six. Gray Sky, the Tappet gelding. Just his third win, but he's always kept good company. So, really a terrific weekend. We'll get all of it in the next couple of days as we recap. And that includes what went on at Santa Anita. John Sadler, who also, you know, had won the turf sprint Friday at Keeneland, that limestone turf with Ginger Nut, that fun race, big group, deep group. She looks like she's going to be very nice. And he wheeled back Campaign. Remember Campaign we talked about going into the big cap? Wheeled him back on 7 days rest and wins the Tokyo Cup yesterday. And I don't know if you noticed this, but both runnings of the Misdirection took place this weekend. Both at Santa Anita and at Aqueduct. It's kind of the craziest thing that I don't know why New York added a Misdirection, what, last year or the year before? And then you had the one Saturday at Santa Anita, too. Peter Miller, Painting Corners, won it, and Mark Cassie won the New York version yesterday with Eye in the Sky. Yeah, it was kind of I didn't realize until yesterday that, you know, I was kind of going through the lineup on the Sunday cards, and I said, oh, the other Misdirection is being run. So both coasts honoring the excellent turf sprinter. And also Mrs. De Tomaso and Graham Motion with the Bridgetown win early on Saturday. Wrigley Irish. Congratulations to Mrs. De Tomaso. And Rajiv, of course, riding in those familiar maroon and gold stripes. And this Wrigley Irish out of a sister of Irish War Cry. And then the last big stake from the weekend, another broad, Todd Pletcher, every weekend. Pletcher moving along on all cylinders right now, without a doubt. Now he probably got to get back to Todd to get some of last week's successes in. Tons to do. And before we reach for our first guest, and really maybe simultaneously, because the first guest is Andy Beyer today, and our last guest will be Steve Crist. Because the as great as the weekend was, yesterday news broke out of Las Vegas that Steve Davidovits had passed away at the age of 77. His son getting the news out, and there's no details yet. And it's, you know, surprised, shocked, and saddened everybody. Because all of us who read handicapping books and written work, we've all read and we've all incorporated the lessons that Steve generously passed along. He, along with Kristen Beyer and, you know, several of the biggest names in handicapping, they all you know, have formed this era's all of us that it really are of any. I mean, I'm 59 years old, and people a little older, and everybody younger, read Betting Thoroughbreds, I imagine. If you haven't, you should. And Steve Davidowitz rewrote it and amended it for the 21st century. But it's the original, that a professional's guide for the horse player, that was, for me, so helpful and so instructive. And in the years that Steve joined me on the show in the aughts, basically, 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, for about at least 5 years, we had the most enjoyable conversations, engaging, smart, irascible, bombastic. Davidowitz was a singular racetrack character, and there's one less character in the racing game with his passing. There'll be tons of appreciations. First on the show here will come from Andy Beyer. And certainly Steve was a huge influence on Andy. Really everybody saddened by this news.
I knew Steve since the early 1970s, and, I'm obviously, extremely sorry to hear to have heard the news yesterday. But I've been kind of thinking back on about Steve, and I got to say that in my life as a horse player, one of the single most momentous moments of my life was a chance encounter on a bench at Saratoga in, I think it was 1971. Where the racing secretary's office and the administration offices are at Saratoga, and it was sort of a place where everybody passed by when you walked into the track, and there were some green benches opposite those offices, and I was sitting there and just struck up a conversation with a young man who was a kind of a contemporary, and it was Steve, and we already had some parallels in our life. I mean, we were both very motivated to become successful handicappers. We each had a big kind of life-changing win that kind of convinced us, that we could make sense of this game and maybe beat the races. But Steve was like way ahead of me. I was at that time just starting to develop my speed figures. I knew I was on the right track, and I was not really far away from developing them into a really powerful handicapping tool. But Steve was way ahead of me, and had kind of a broad understanding of the game, and a philosophy of it that really enlightened me. I mean, he was working at, I can't keep all of his employment history straight, but I believe at that time he was working as a handicapper at the Daily Racing Form, and he was exposed to the past performances and racing data from tracks all around the country. That was in that pre-computer era. I don't know if you remember this, Steve. There were just regional editions of the racing form, so you saw your local track in New York and maybe a couple of others. I mean, you'd never like see a set of past performances for Keeneland, but Steve had a kind of a national view, and he understood that, you know, the great variances in the game. And that, you know, maybe there was one handicapping factor that was the key to the game at the fairgrounds, and something else was vital at Saratoga. And so he had developed a real arsenal of handicapping weapons, but I mean there are two respects in which he really influenced my understanding of the game. And number one was his recognition of the importance of track biases, and it was he who coined that phrase, which has kind of endured in handicapping. And he knew the importance of spotting the existence of a bias and capitalizing on it. And I would say, in talking to him, I mean, that was the great revelation, that I got from him in those early years, because biases were much, much more prevalent at that time than they are today. I mean, you would have tracks like Pimlico where, like, every day, everybody won on the rail, and other tracks where the rail was dead and everybody swooped wide. And by just honing in on those tracks and certain types of running styles, that alone was a powerful tool. And his other great emphasis was on trainers and trainer patterns at a time when, I think the existing handicapping literature really didn't focus so much on it, but Steve wanted to see who was the wise guy and how certain guys won and follow them, and those two parts of the game became a big part of my arsenal, thanks to Steve. And when I finally got my speed figures honed to where I want them, I was able to combine them with some of these other handicapping factors, particularly track biases, and really turn them into the figures into really a powerful betting tool.
You know, one of the things, Andy, that you credit Steve with, and I think back to the foreword that you wrote for Betting Thoroughbreds, and it may have been the second edition. It's not the new one, but you talked about being impressed with how well-rounded Steve was as a handicapper, and his early appreciation for avoiding the system trap or certain a narrow focus of a path to success, and being able to also to adapt and to grow. And you even hinted at how Betting Thoroughbreds evolved from from the first you know, the first set of lessons that, that Steve wrote about. And then, you know, even Steve acknowledged the changes and incorporated pace, you know, into the second edition. And, you know, things that as he learned them, he was willing to acknowledge that that this was an imperfect science and that everybody, no matter how accomplished, is always growing as a player.
Right. I mean, in picking winners, I'd written that, you know, that, that I, like a lot of horse players, was out there looking for the secret of beating the race, you know, with a capital S. And, and I was kind of, I was definitely on that track with the speed figures, which for me did prove to be the big secret. But Steve, Steve had a, Steve understood the great variances in the game, from time to time and place to place, and that you always had to adapt. I mean, I should mention, I had the opportunity to write a book before Steve did. I mean, really, if in a just world, he would have written, betting thoroughbreds first, and expounded the concept of track biases. I mean, I got into print first, my explanation, my discussion of biases was a large part of it was writing about Steve. But I beat him into print with a couple of his own ideas, I feel I always gave him due credit, but he was in my life. He was the first kid on the block who understand the power of track biases.
Well, and there's any number of things that I think people think of him. The key race concept was something that was certainly attributed to Steve, and he. It's funny because he's such a unique character and had such an unusual way about him. But listening to him talk, and he brought his. He brought his knowledge to countless racetracks. The way he was employed in at Canterbury and later at Sunland, and there's so many pockets of people that had opportunities to hear him and listen to him firsthand. In addition to reading his work, and he was prolific too. I mean, he wrote whenever the a subject struck him, and the amount of information and his willingness to help people learn the game, that I think is going to stay with a lot of players forever.
Yeah, by the way, the key race idea, I mean, the concept and the phrase was his, and that also has stuck, in the lexicon of handicapping.
Absolutely. I had the conversations for 5-6 years where Steve was virtually weekly visitor, personally, for me, betting thoroughbreds and picking winners, were the two that that I read that got me engaged in the game. And I wrote a tweet yesterday, Steve, with the learning of Steve's passing. That, and I said this to him on the air many times, that betting thoroughbreds had like a stream of consciousness to it, almost like a Zen feel to it. I remember telling him, he must have just been in a zone when he wrote all the things down that make up the book, because I can just, in the times that I've read it and gone back and reread it, there's just such a perfect tone to it, and it you know, it's easy to understand. I mean, he conveyed the ideas and the methods just really naturally. And I just remember, you know, having after reading it, feeling like I understood the game better.
Yeah, and Steve was a good writer. It was a shame that he, particularly in his later years, that he never got, you know, like good. You know, he was really kind of scuffling for outlets, you know, where he could write. In the course of our lifetimes, I mean, the number of the number of newspapers who have full time turf riders is, you know, diminished to, you know, like one or two, and you know, it's just, you know, it's a. I mean, if you're a journalist, a writer with a, especially in horse racing, you know, there just aren't that many places to make a living anymore. So it was kind of a tough, found himself in a tough environment as racing changed over the years.
Well, and he did conceive of the website that he launched, and it ultimately didn't make it. But the Grade One racing concept that even in that concept, it was innovative and was ahead of its time. The idea of incorporating widespread clocking information into a package.
Yep.
That was ahead of the curve.
It was indeed, yes.
Yeah. Andy, we're going to talk to Steve later as well, Steve Crist, and I imagine to some degree that this is one of those passings that makes people feel old, but I imagine that to some extent it does.
It does, and it was just almost exactly a year ago to the day that Bill Knack died, another of my lifelong horse racing / journalism colleagues. So I guess we're all remembering our own mortality.
Well, certainly work, continues to keep you occupied, and the conversation, we had the anniversary of picking winners, in fact, last year, and speaking of innovation at DRF, I want to point out the Ask Andy feature as opposed to Dear Abby. This is Dear Andy.
Right. Well, the DRF decided to put a buyer speed figure page on their website that has if people haven't seen it, it has a lot of, you know, a lot of good data, particularly the historical data that used to be only in the American Racing Manual, with the top speed figures for America's horses every year and in every category, you know, back to the 1990s. So for racing junkies, it's a lot of interesting stuff. But they asked me if I would do a Q&A, for readers who had questions about the figures. And I actually readily embraced the idea because I've never wanted the buyer speed figures to be some mystical thing. I want people to understand them. And a lot of times, you know, when people look and see a quirk, a horse who runs 6 furlongs at 110 gets a lower figure on the same day than a horse who goes in 110.8, you know, they react, you know, buyer's lost his mind, this is stupid, you know. And in fact, there's a reason when that happens. And so I kind of like the idea of having an outlet to explain the things we do, and I'm having fun with it.
Well, and I'll send the link out on Twitter to it, and you can Ask Andy Beyer, basically. And if you, the new format of DRF takes a little getting used to. If you click on the news and info tab, it'll then give you a header bar, and the Beyer speed figure page is on the right. And that will bring you to it, and then in the middle of the page, a little bit right, email questions, and you can read prior questions that Andy has been answering. And Andy, on that topic, right. I mean, obviously, we'll talk about the Derby in coming weeks, but there's something that's going to be on display for people when they open up Derby Day to look at DRF, and Omaha Beach has one of the rare patterns of a horse whose Beyer has increased with every single start.
Well, you know, I think he's, I'm not sure why they were thinking that he was a turf horse early in his life when he didn't run all that well. But he's, I think, you know, aside from that quirk, he, you know, by modern standards, he's got, you know, pretty good overall preparation going into this race, and the trainer who knows how to do it. I mean, he's, I think, narrowly at the top of the list.
And I do want to ask you about Saturday, because it seemed like it was a particularly quirky day to have to make figures.
It was totally chaotic. I mean, we just see more and more cases where racetracks just change radically during the course of a day. And, okay, on Oaklawn, it was raining all day. I guess that's understandable. But sometimes, you know, when the sun is shining at a track all day and it's fast, you'll see races just come up 20 points fast or 20 points slow for no reason. And there were, you know, there were races at Oaklawn that just bore no relation to anything else. I mean, fortunately, there were 2 mile-and-an-eighth races on the card, you know, one of them for well-established older horses, and actually all the route, the last four route races all hung together. So, when Randy Moss, who does our Oakland figures, and Mark Hopkins, my partner, and I all looked at it, we all came up with independently with virtually the identical numbers for the route races. So at least we're confident about them. But boy, along the way, they sure bounced around.
You could tell, too, I mean, that the day, and it almost felt like maybe the track was speeding up late in the day, and I was anxious, and I was traveling yesterday, so I kept checking, and you had the early part of the card done, and you had Mitoli's big 107, and then it took another couple of hours before everybody agreed. Right?
I think Randy was in deep thought. but usually we try to get the high profile races out there, you know, sometimes, you know, with an hour or so after the race, but when you have a tough day like this, we sometimes need to sleep on it and ruminate.
Sure.
About it, because while we have no shame about changing figures that we've already published as circumstances demand, but we if it's a maiden 8500 claiming race at Laurel, I mean, we'll do it unhesitatingly. But when you're talking about, you know, the figure for the probable Kentucky Derby favorite, we want to get it right the first time. So that was the reason for the delay. But, you know, I think the 101 is solid.
Well, Andy, we'll talk in the coming weeks as we get closer to Oaks and Derby. I appreciate you taking the time this morning to remember Steve Davidowitz.
My pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
Andy Beyer, everybody. And later we'll talk to Steve Crist at the end of the show as well. And in a really the proverbial Mount Rushmore of handicapping writing, Davidowitz, Beyer, Crist, and your fourth. The fourth depends on what kind of player you are. If you're a pace player, it might be Quirin. So, or Quinn. So it depends on your approach. No matter what your approach, you have to be just impressed with the Asmussen team's success over the weekend, and the Racing Festival of the South, usually the end of the meet, but, in this particular case, it'll continue for another 3 weeks. But, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Steve Asmussen sent out, winners in big spots. It started Friday with the filly, and Steve was particularly excited, I thought, and happy with Lady Apple for Phoenix. Wins the fantasy Mitoli then in the sprint on Saturday, and then yesterday Midnight Bisou continues her distaffing in the Apple Blossom, the grade one win. Steve, congratulations on a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
You were giving off the vibes on Friday. I got to tell you, I was doing an impromptu camera video, and you gave me a little interview. Everybody loved it, but you seemed to really think Lady Apple was ready to pop.
Well, she's a quality filly. Obviously, Fantasy was a very deep field, and it was her first two-turn stakes try, and she came through with flying colors.
She ran great, and you got a tremendous ride. Talk about Ricardo's efforts and rallying up the rail.
Right. It worked out extremely well. Ricardo's had a lot of confidence in the filly, and he worked out a dream trip for her, and we were all very happy with the win, happy with the outcome.
I was up on the little rail at the gap, and you were a couple people deep. And when you saw her mid stretch, you started to give a little hoot, and I looked behind me, and I got a big kick. And you were all smiles, as everybody was. And I know Phoenix and Katie Rich. She was a Katie Rich homebred, and then Phoenix. Did Phoenix buy her at auction, and then Katie Rich came back in?
Katie Rich started her first time out at Keeneland, and Tom Lute, representing Phoenix, purchased the majority of her off of her first race, and Katie Rich stayed in.
There you go. Well, what's interesting is that as a two-year-old, she showed signs, and the fact that you started her in the Astoria and then later in the Schuylerville, you obviously felt that there was quality there, but it didn't really come together until the first start this year. You gave her some time off between August and then into February. Talk about her being turned out and giving a chance to kind of mature a little.
Yeah, as you said, she ran in the Schuylerville and the Astoria as a two-year-old, and gave her some time off at Becky Makers in Lexington. And I think with, as all the Curlins, time helps. And she's come back a solid filly, and filly to be taken very seriously now.
Yeah, and when she came back, she caught Slop in her maiden win, and that was at six. Then you came back with the mile and a 16th allowance win, and so she's 3 for 3 as a 3-year-old, and you get to head to Churchill with a filly that coming into the Oaks hot.
Yes, and as you said, 3 for 3 on the year, and both of her two-turn races she's won.
Well, this was also maybe the last time we're getting 10 to 1 on her as well. That I don't know.
With the likes of the field in the Oaks, I don't think you have to worry about that. I think you're probably still in that range at least right now.
We're still going to get a price. All right, folks. So you don't despair. That was part of what really turned into a nice weekend. I do want to ask Steve before we talk about Mattioli and about yesterday, the nightcap on Friday. And you sent Comedian and Troyounce, and that was a very heady group in there. And the race kind of got blown apart by the winner. This was the kind of weekend it was. I mean, the allowance races and maidens, they were all deep, all 3 days.
Well, I think for the money they're running at Oaklawn, that is to be expected, and if anything, the races will get deeper. You saw the horses that shipped in, especially from California, for the allowance races that accompanied their stake horses and made for some very exciting racing this weekend.
Well, and you actually, as well, in addition to the stake wins, we should mention Poets Dreamed, the daughter of Lady Tack for Hill and Dale, and a McLean's Music. So happy to get her a win in her debut. And that Pyron looks like there's upside there with him.
Yeah, as you mentioned, just the program here at Oaklawn with what they've done with it has definitely stepped up. And to win those races, it's going to take plenty of ability, and we are blessed with some extremely nice horses. The McLean's Music out of Lady Tack, obviously very special to us. Lady Tack was our first millionaire ever, and
and
a very substantial filly to us. And having McLean's Music for his one run as well, wouldn't expect that filly to be anything but talented.
I want to ask too about this was a John Secura bred Stretch Run Ventures. Is that one of the partnership groups that he's put together?
I believe so. Yes.
Yeah, he's got the guys.
Nice group of people that have a quality filly. And Lady Tack was by Mutoctum, who Mr. Secura stood at the time, and I'm sure that's where his interest and admiration in Lady Tack started, and she's going to come through for us.
Well, it's one of those funny things when you get to this point in a Hall of Fame career, Steve, when you've got the sire and the dam, and you train them both. That's either a sign of getting older, or
how great
the career's been.
Getting older, I used to think it was a normalcy when you had a half to one previously. Now I'm second and third damn deep into this thing,
I always kid Shug McGahee about that. Shug's training fourth generations. I remember when I had the damn,
yeah,
the dam's damn thing.
And it makes it very special for me. It's just the similarities, and it just the tendencies that I think being fortunate to, just like the, Lady Apple being a daughter of Curlin, competitiveness and the desire to win that they show, it's one of the many things that make horse racing so special.
No doubt. Let's talk Mattioli, and obviously, if he stays sound and stays right, things are gonna boil down to a terrific sprint division battle the rest of the way. And obviously with the way conditions were, Steve, he was going to be tough to beat in here, but it was still a powerhouse performance.
Yes, he's unbelievably fast horse.
Yeah.
He just is, and I think that it'll be pretty hard for him not to get his way because of how fast he is.
And how soon, how soon do you pick a spot? How far do you want to go with him? Some people were saying, gosh, is this a horse that could go to the Met Mile, for instance?
Well, he obviously has a talent level that I think is worthy of a grade one level. This the count fleet, as you mentioned, but that was his second run of the year. I think we need to take that into consideration and try to put a couple more blocks in place to build a substantial racing career for this horse.
All right, well, we'll wait and watch and see where you shake out. Before we talk about Apple Blossom yesterday, let's talk about the Derby. And, of course, Long Range Toddy was all set. He's ready for Churchill, but you also sent out Laughing Fox, who ran well and who's going to have a good year for the Lieblongs. And Jersey Agenda and Teak Van Flew, your thoughts about what we saw in the Derby?
I thought we saw some fabulous three-year-olds. I definitely feel that the trifecta in the Arkansas Derby will be on many a trifecta and superfecta ticket for the Derby. It just a very deep field. Going into the Derby, it'll be interesting to see the conditions in which the Derby possibly will run under that will be different from the wet weather that we got in Arkansas this week.
Well, and certainly the last few years, we've had wet conditions at Churchill, and it just seems like more often than not. Give us a feel for how Long Range Toddy performed. You know, clearly it's nice to win a $1 million race or be prominent, but he was outposted, and it was going to be a little tricky for John Court to work out a trip. Some thoughts about how you position him in 3 weeks.
Well, as you mentioned, draw wasn't what you would have chose for yourself, and the conditions in which the race was run isn't exactly what you would have chosen. But that scenario is possible. Be recreated in Louisville, but he came out of the race in good shape, and he is in transit to Churchill Downs right now, and I'm anxious to see how he prepares under the twin spires.
Well, and certainly excited for John Court to have another Derby mount, and Long Range Toddy heading to the Downs. How quickly do you break camp here with the horses that ran this weekend, the stake horses? They all go into Churchill?
Several of the Saturday horses went today, and Midnight Basu will go tomorrow. Felt to give her today to pet on her and admire her, and then she will head to Louisville tomorrow.
Well, and I suppose there's plenty of these candidates out of this race, even, and others, for something like the Pat Day Mile.
You're right. That is a possibility.
Who do you think on the turn? I mean, certainly Teak Van Flew is a turnback candidate. And I, you know, Laughing Fox looks like he could be a terrific one-turn mile type.
Well, I think that both of those horses are big, growthy horses that are still in their development stage. They're not who they're going to end up being, and we need to pay attention to that and let these horses continue to physically develop before we pigeonhole them.
There you go. Well, and of course, Laughing Fox is a Union Rags, and we know, based on him and his progeny, what they can do. Teak Van Flew, Street Sense out of a deputy minister, so plenty versatile. And that was only his fourth start. So we'll keep watching, and certainly you'll be active in all the regional derbies that you've won countless times, West Virginia and so forth. Steve, let's talk about yesterday. And I don't think anybody was surprised that there was a stretch battle involving Midnight Bizou. They just didn't expect the Manitoba bred to be engaged in it.
Well, I think that respect needs to be given any mare that's 20 wins and 30 starts in their life knows how to win and knows how to compete. And obviously, it's probably been in that position before. very, you know, very impressed with Escape Clause's performance as well. Feel very blessed and fortunate that we're in the Midnight Bisou camp, and you know, she continues to come through and do the whole team proud.
This was really exciting, and you know, did you sense at a certain point that Mike was Mike Smith was being a little overconfident with her?
No, Mike, I appreciate so much how much respect Mike has for the filly, how in tune he is with her, and I think that he has made her, you know, a happier horse pre-race, before the race, during the race, and after the race, and I think all of that comes together. He knows the mare extremely well. He's got I think that's, you know, Mike's talent is obvious, but the thing that I appreciate most about him is his respect for horses and how much he truly loves them.
You have you and Jeff Bloom and Sal Kumin, the ownership side of things. You've got really a wealth of opportunity, Steve, with her. I mean, the New York distaff program, where there's a lot of one-turn opportunities. She's obviously just as adept two-turning. What kind of things do you guys have in mind?
Well, we're obviously excited about the way she started off the year, 3-for-3, and what we feel is 3 very significant races. We're obviously delighted with yesterday's outcome, very pleased with her today. As I said, we're just going to pet on her and admire her today, and then she will travel to Churchill, which will be her home base for the next couple of months, and decide where she should run off of that, with the long-term goal being the Breeders' Cup.